I'm here in Enniskillen and I'm talking to Clive Miller.
Yeah.
Clive, tell me your story. Were you affected by the Troubles?
Yes.
How?
From a young age, from I remember as far back as with my father, when my father was on the UDR, where we live in the border area. And then, because of threats and them trying to murder my father, it ended up then we were moved from the border area. That's how we come to here. That's actually the home place that we moved to.
And so how long are you... Where were you living? Where were you brought up?
We were brought up out near... it would have been close... It was called the Five Points, which have been close to the Swadlin Bar border. So it would have been about 5 miles from the border, in the border area where we lived.
And how many brothers and sisters? Was there a big family there of you?
I had 4 brothers and 1 sister, but because I was the youngest in the family, my sister had already moved off. She'd went to England. And my older brother, he had got married and moved off. So there was only at that time then, there was me other 2 older brothers at that time living at home, which one of them was in the UDR as well as with my father. So he was.
And your father was a member of the UDR?
He was a member of the part-time UDR, yeah.
And was he, you say his life was threatened a few times, was
yeah.
it?
Yeah, they'd come to the house a couple of times looking for him. And then there was other members of their section who had been killed. And then at that time, then Dad was moved from where we were out at that area. The family was moved then in here because the army camp was just up the road here.
And that was for safety?
Yeah, for his own safety, yeah. So it was. And that's how we ended up here. We ended up here in 1980. 1980 we come here. I was only 12. I'd been 12 whenever we come here.
Yeah.
So we were.
So can you talk me through those early days? Was there a lot of tension in the town? Was there, this was an army garrison, wasn't it? I mean, this is where the army were stationed.
In the younger years before they moved here, I would never know, because where would have been, as a younger child in primary school, it would have been just where I went to primary school and back home and where it was in the country. So there really was, I would never have been in the town at that age. I would never have, unless I went in the town of my mother's shopping or something, if she took me in with her. But other than that, there I wouldn't have known. So I wouldn't be aware of what way the town was at that stage. It was later on when we moved here and I was 12. And then in the town, you'd have seen what the division was or the divide were. Basically, as the Catholics went one way, the Protestants went the other. And then was growing up then, as in the division, even it was like a gauntlet to get through the town. And I'm talking when you're going older, 14, 15, 16, where it was as I suppose it was the same on either side, as where if the other side got you, they got a hiding. Or if we got one of them, they got a hiding. But that's the way it was through division.
Was the town divided in that way? Would you say that this area that you're now living in was a staunch Protestant community? Or would you say it's all very much mixed?
Enniskillen would be mixed. But in the sense then, as what you'd have had going back then, where you had your Protestant housing estates and your Catholic housing estates. This area here was solely just Protestant. Chanter Hill across the town was another Protestant housing estate, and Darachara was another Protestant housing estate. And then you had then on the Catholic side, you had Corner-Great, Hillview, Kilmacormack, Cavanaugh. So it was divided.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
I do, yeah. They were kept apart, really. I mean, you were afraid to go into that area, I'd say. Were you, or was that something?
No, you wouldn't have went into it.
Yeah.
In the sense is that you wouldn't have went into that area.
Yeah.
As being a Protestant, going into it.
Were you destined then to follow your father's footsteps and to become... were you a part-time member of the UD Army?
No, I joined the regular army.
Did you?
Yeah. I joined the regular army.
As a paratrooper? Or?
No, it was a Royal Irish Ranger. I joined, and then things happened. But even when I had went, even when I'd went to the army, where to come back home and leave, where on a couple of occasions was that they said there was threats and that I wasn't allowed to come home and leave. So even being away...
Away where now?
Like when I was in, even, well, I was up in Ballymena doing my training, and I was told one time there was leave to come home, and I was told that I couldn't come home because there was a threat. And then one time when I was in Germany, the same whenever the battalion was going on leave, I was told that there was a threat and there was an issue, I couldn't go home. But then it sort of, they got it sorted then, was that on the condition I could come home, that I had to report twice a day down to the army camp to report in there.
I see.
Twice a day, like, so yeah. I got to come home. And then basically then, I suppose then I just came back, my first marriage, and I got a house just up the road here from my mother and father. So I still come back to the same area. And then I went to work then in the security camps in the construction end of it, and worked then around the police stations and that around the country as well. And in that time then there was a couple of issues of being targeted. And then also then was that there was an issue then is that, and I had went into hospital, and I wasn't meant to go into hospital, but I went into hospital this day and had an operation, but I got out that evening, and under the effect of the anaesthetic I went to bed, and that, which I didn't, unannounced, I didn't know till the next morning. And then at 7:30 when I awakened, the army and the police and all was outside, and the ex-wife, or the wife at the time, she turned around and she said, "What do you call it?" I says, "What are they here for?" I says, "They were here at 1 o'clock this morning," says, "checking." They said, "The what he called it, they got a message or something that there was meant to be a bomb planted under the car." So they checked all up where the other house was, and then I came down and checked down around here to see in case that it either had dropped off or where it was down, over the car driving down to here to my parents, like, so. But they never got anything. But I did inquire after, and I did ask, and what they told me was it was a coded message, that they had got a coded message from the IRA that there was a bomb had been planted under the car, like.
My, yeah.
So I don't.
And so were you ever out with other soldiers, and were you ever involved in a skirmish, or were you ever sniped at, or?
The only instance that I had was one was whenever the mortar down at Skillen Police Station, the mortars went off. And I didn't know at the time that my leg was cut. I got shrapnel in it. And then the only other occasion was when I was standing down where the three soldiers was blowing up. It was actually a fishing competition. And I'd went down to my father. And the next thing, I was standing next and just bang up, the fan went. And there was a man, his legs were blowing off just above his knees. And he was still conscious, like. And his whole hair was on fire. He was burning. And my father took my brother's jumper and put the fire out. And he pulled the plastic fishing trousers on, and he pulled them off to stop them burning into his legs. And as he pulled them off, his wallet fell out, and it was his army ID. So knew then it was soldiers, like.
Yeah.
So it was. So, but even the smell of the burning, and it's even then afterwards where they just come around and just swept the pieces up, like, and shoveled them in the bags, like.
Yeah. So that is. But did that play in your mind? I mean, did you have to live with that?
I don't know, because even it's something I grew up with all my life. So it at the time it didn't feel not normal. Because even with at home, like, and even as children, where when my father was going out on duty, like on a summer's day, say, where we had to be brought into the house before he went out.
Yeah.
And then whenever he left, because you knew, I suppose as children you didn't pass any marks at the time, but when he left, then you were allowed back out to play again in the summer evenings. And then what we used to do was, there was a crossroads where they called it the Five Points. And what we used to do is we used to go up and hide in the hedge. And then the next thing then is, this was like maybe half an hour after that he'd left the house. And the next thing up, I'd pull the Land Rovers and they'd do a checkpoint, and we'd be hiding in the hedge watching them do the checkpoint. So we did. And there was some things like before my father passed away, like, and before he took Alzheimer's, and talking to him, I remember saying, you know, told him some of the things that we had seen, and they never ever knew that we'd been hiding in the hedge watching them, like.
Imagine that.
Yeah. So that, and then when they'd have done their checkpoint, that had moved on, and whenever they left, then we'd just come back to the house, like.
Yeah. So there was a certain sense of excitement for a young kid, you know, was there?
It was, I think it was more excitement, but more the novelty of the army. It was like a, I don't know, it was like brilliant, yeah. Like, you know what I mean?
Of course.
And then I suppose that would have been part of the reason, I suppose, maybe of myself joining up, because I left school for my 16th birthday. And I got a job in the local meat arbiter, and I stayed there for 2 years. And I suppose in the same sense, and all the time, I'm thinking of joining. And it was a good job, full-time job, well paid. But I still decided, I'm going to go. So went off and I signed up, and away I went, like. So I did. So
I see.
It didn't bother me going.
So the reason you joined the army was because you felt that you were cut out to be an army person.
I think so. I think it would have been in my father and him being in it, and different bits and pieces that he had said, for he was in Enniskillen Fusiliers. He was in it, and then he'd been to different places. He was in,
doing foreign service.
Yeah. I can't even remember the place. Can't get the right. But where it was, where he was in active service. He was in Egypt, he was all over the world, like, and sort of. I thought I'd try that. But the army had totally changed from my father was in it till I went, like, because places where they were posted and places they got the army didn't have them postings when I joined, like. You didn't get them places, like. So it was, but good and enjoyable.
Tell me, where were you when the bomb went off here in Enniskillen?
I was in Osnabrück in Germany, and because we were an hour ahead, we had already done our parade in the camp, like the army, and we had been down after the parade was done. We went down to the bar, and one of the fellas came in, but he would have been a real raker, like. And he came in and he said to me, here, sweet, he says, Enniskillen's after being blown up. Get away with that. And sort of didn't believe him. But there would have been at that time, in and around 15 of us there from Enniskillen who was serving. And we were all sitting. And the next thing then, another man came in and he goes, no, he says, he's not joking. Like, he says, seriously, he says, Enniskillen's after being blown up. Like, and I knew, because my father, he played in the Ballyrae band, and where the bomb actually was is where he would have been standing. And we were all brought down up to the guard room, and because the whole network phones and all was down, so the whole day they couldn't even get through to Northern Ireland to find out what was going on or if everybody was all right. My mother used to go down as well every remembering Sunday morning, and then actually what I found out was that night on the German news, it was 9 o'clock, so the whole day had waited to try and get through. The army couldn't get through, nobody could get any communications at all. And it was that night the German news came on showing it, and I seen my father actually pulling somebody out of the rubble, like. So, right. So he was, so I knew he was all right, like. So it had, if any of the clips you ever see on it, it's all as him, that's nearly all as showing on it, him pulling the people out. And then whenever I come home, and I spoke to him, and he said it's only for the fact that one of the band members was actually late, and they waited. Only for that there, the whole lot would have been down at the cenotaph.
Really?
Yeah, everybody would have been there, like. So they would have.
And that really wrecked the town. It killed so many people. It was one of the worst atrocities of the Troubles. To be so far away, did you really want to be at home at that stage?
Did I? Whenever, especially that day, like, but you couldn't get home, so you couldn't.
But yeah,
the way it was when you're away in the army, you just can't say, right, I'm going home here, I'll be back next week. It's when they tell you you're going home, that's when you're going home.
Yeah,
but it was like, as then, hey, I seen it on the news, so seen him, but I still wasn't aware whether my mother was safe or not. And then it was actually, I think it was after 1 o'clock that night, that the fancy then got through, even to ring home. You couldn't get through because the whole phone lines were completely blocked and Enniskillen. The fancy got through then and found out then that she was okay as well. Like, so it was.
Yeah.
But.
And did that make you even more bitter? I mean, did you really want to do something about that? To get your own back? I mean, was that something that...
It would have been, and a part of it would be that you'd have wanted to go to do something back or to retaliate for it. I think then the bigger part of it is because that was in November and I didn't get home till March after that. So I think more in the sense then is I wasn't here, so I didn't see it. Do you know what I mean? Yes, I was annoyed it happened. But I think more then is because it was completely out of the scenario, I wasn't here. So I think it was more different then when I did come home for things that sort of, I suppose, settled down or
yeah,
wasn't at the time. But I know at the time my father told me, he said that what he called, he says that in the town, like, it was very, very, very bad bitterness between both sides, like, with the whole thing, like.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there was. But I think more me not being here would have been maybe more of a blessing in the sense is that I wasn't here to go through it or see it or whatever the case may be, you know what I mean? So it was better in that way, like, not being here.
Of course, yeah, I understand. And did you feel, or did you ever ask your father afterwards about that moment when, you know, he was there, he experienced what had happened? What was going through? Did he talk about it to you at any stage?
Very briefly. Very briefly, Dad would have talked. He would never have been one. Dad would never have been one. This, like, even when, like, when he passed away, and whenever then his cousin and that who was in the army with him, and only then you heard at the wake where he was telling stories of what they'd done and what he'd seen. But Dad would have been a very reserved, was he just done it, got on with it, and that was it. He'd sort of kept himself. He wouldn't have been one to tell stories or I know there was a programme was done, I think it might have been the BBC done it. I think it was the BBC. And was where they'd done the interview with the band members who had went down and helped and all. And even I think even that night, like, they were when it was broadcast and they were asking me, he just sort of didn't.
Yeah,
it was more like he kept all to himself, you know, and he just carried on, like,
so just bottled up inside. Yeah, so he did.
So, but then in saying that, when he passed away, like, Dad would have been very, very well thought of in the town here, and even when he passed away, which I was surprised, there was actually men there who was actually members of the IRA at his funeral.
Was there?
Yeah.
What was your dad's first name?
Freddie.
So your life as a soldier, did you continue? Are you still a soldier?
No.
So when did you retire?
I left back at the end of the 80s, again 90s, and then what actually happened was I met this girl, she got pregnant. And then it was like I didn't want to get married in the army. And then it sort of was then, so the option was then I could get work to work in the security camps with near treble the wages. So what I done was I left the army then to come and work in the security camps where you got paid far more money. Like, to me, it was normal. It was a job, and the work that it was, don't know, it was just, I suppose, just the same as if you were working in a building site in a housing estate or something. It was no different, like. Yes, there was the threat, or had been targeted, and it's literally a 5-minute walk from here up to the camp. And I used to come down in the evening, come down for 5 o'clock, and my mother would have made me something to eat. And I went back up again at 5:30 to go back up and work overtime. And then there was an incident then on the evening when drowned, I seen this man. And all he done was he stood, he looked at me, looked at his watch, and walked off. So I thought, something's not right here. But it would have been because of my army training to spot things. And then the second evening I went, he was back again at the same location, exact same thing. Looked at me, looked at his watch, and walked on. I thought it was strange again. And on the third evening, there was 2 men with him. But they were wearing like a, you know them coats that you could sip up where the face sort of sipped up?
Yeah.
But their faces I couldn't see. So I went up then to the camp and I said to my mate, who had been in the army with me and him left the same time and ended up working together as well from here. And I said to him about it. And he says, you need to go up to the end cell. So I went to the end cell and then they had actually brought me then to show me the sighting list. And they asked me to go through to see, could I find it, and flick through. And lo and behold, the boy's picture was in it. The boy that I seen the first and second day. So what they told me then was, they maintained that the 2 men that had their faces covered with the coat, that they would have been the 2 gunmen, that they were just there to confirm who I was. Basically, they'd have done the shooting. So then they put a thing in place, and it was where they cordoned the whole area off here with the army and the police. And they told me that I was to walk down the same road, but I wasn't allowed to walk on the right hand side beside the phone box. Quite obviously the army was in waiting in cover or whatever.
Yeah.
And as I got down, I could see the man, the same man standing. And as I got to the corner, they told me not to stop, just keep walking. And at that there then, there was a patrol that came behind me. And whenever they called him, he went to take off running. But they got him then where you went up into that area of Wilmington Heights. The police got him up there. But whenever they brought him to question him, all he had on him was his watch and 10p. And he told him that he was going to make a phone call because there was a phone box down there. And that's what he said, he was going to make a phone call. But where he lived, he would be about 15 odd mile from here.
Yeah.
So he had no reason to be down there to make a phone call, like, but they couldn't do anything. And then because they never found out or they never seen who the other 2 people was. But
yeah,
they told me that they maintained that that's what they were. They were the 2. They would have been the 2 gunmen that had done the job, like.
So the way you told that story, I mean, it would suggest that, okay, but you were trained and you kind of knew what was going on. But if somebody was trying to kill you, it must have been. It must have put you on alert, and you must have been that kind of, from the morning you step out of bed until the evening you come home into bed, you're living in terror, in fear, or did you see it like that?
It wasn't, that's the thing, it didn't seem like it. Because it was no different from what being a child to then. Because it all just seemed normal. Like when I was young, as a young child in primary school, like we're, with my father being in the UDR and that, I knew how to shoot the gun. Do you know what I mean? My father had showed us, me and the brothers, how to shoot. If anything happened, how to shoot the guns. So as a child, and even with them coming to the house looking for my father, so there was, from a very young childhood, that element was still there.
Yeah.
So really it never was like a, I don't know how to explain this. Like say for instance, say, right, you'd never know dealings with like of a threat or of anything, and then there was a threat on you, you'd be sort of like, I suppose, worried, petrified, thinking, Jesus, they're going to kill me or whatever. But I think the other hand then is of growing up with knowing nothing different.
Yeah.
It really wasn't. It wasn't. Of course, it was always in the back of your mind, but it was never panicking or anything overt. I don't know. It was
a way of life.
That just, yeah. I suppose you just accepted that was the way life was.
Imagine.
But it wasn't normal at all.
So when the peace talks came about, and when we had the Good Friday Agreement, were you happy with that? Were you content that now maybe we have peace in Northern Ireland? What was going through your mind at that time?
I don't know. I suppose maybe the bigger part is thinking is if there was going to be peace on the count for my children, that they wouldn't have had to grow up as children, as in the same circumstances as myself, like going to school, bomb scares, the likes of, I remember coming home on the bus, and where like the Catholics sat one end of the bus, the Protestants sat the other end of the bus. And then it came out in the news that one of the UDR men had been killed, who would have been in the same section as my father, and a friend then on the bus, and him basically got up and he beat a Catholic on the bus because his father, my father, and this that man was killed, were all on the UDR together, like.
Mm.
And where this fellow was from was sort of out closer to the in the border area. And the fella got up and he just out of it battered this fella on the bus, like, because simple fact, he was a Catholic, and the fact is that this man had just been killed, like.
Yeah.
So that was sort of, and then when we come here, it was different because then that time where we lived out there, you had to commute on the bus with Catholics and Protestants together to bring you in from the country to the schools. But when we come here, that then that all completely separated, because the bus that picked us up here only picked up the Protestants. So no Catholics got the bus with us to go to the school here, like. So the buses weren't even mixed, so they weren't. So.
But are you happy now that?
Oh, I'm very happy now. Like I say, I have three children there in school. One's 8, the other's, he'll be 10 next month. And the eldest boy's 14. And where they are now, they're all, like as I say, I'm a mixed marriage, but they went till, we sent them to the integrated school. But where they are now, there's no issue at all. They all go off, they all do their things, which is far, far better. It is better. And in the sense of looking back, I think, and I've said this often before, the way society is today, if a child was brought up today in the way we were brought up in them sort of situations back then, and they would class it, it would be classed as a form of child abuse or in society today, the way the children was reared back then, but then to us then was just normal. Do you know what I mean?
I know it, and in hindsight, looking back at the way you were brought up and the way that you lived, do you feel now that was the wrong way? That wasn't the way that it should have been, or was there any choice? You know, did you have a choice?
No, I didn't have a choice as a child, because my father's choice that he was in UDR, so I suppose that came part and parcel with my life. What you're saying is, should have been different. Of course it should have been different. It could have been a lot different. Like my father, I went out to work in a garage, and there was an old man, Pat Joe Leonard his name was, and bumped in, he came in, he was in his late 70s, and he asked me who it was, and I told him, and he says, I remember, he says, your father, well, he says, we used to go to the 12th and drink orange beer, and we used to go to Paddy's Day and drink green beer. So it ended up anyway, and I come home and I asked my father, I said, do you remember him? He says, oh, I do. He says, I remember Pat Joe. So it ended up, It ended up he took cancer, and he was in the nursing home. And I said to Dad, he says, do you want to go and see him? And him and Dad was very good friends, just before the trouble started. And I went and I got the McCarry out of Guinness, and I brought the Dad to see him in the nursing home, and I just sat in the corner, and it was like two lost friends met again, and they sat and had their beer, and they chatted about old times and all. And I remember after them, whenever we left, nice as the die, he says, was things so different? He says, the troubles was the worst thing, he says, that ruined, he says, because back then, he says, everybody went together to whatever was the 12th, whether it was Paddy's Day, he says, that all, and then he says, whenever the trouble started, it just put a divide between the two sides, and that's where it sort of went from. And like even my father, who would have been like a Protestant and come from a Protestant area in Lisbeloa, and where my father had a tattoo on his arm with the shamrock with Ireland wrote it.
I was going to ask, did he really? And how, if I could ask you the question, do you feel Irish or do you feel English?
I feel neither. I wouldn't class myself as being Irish, and I wouldn't class myself as being English, but I'd class myself as being an Ulster man.
Okay.
That's me. Like, I'm Northern Ireland, that's, to me, he's an Ulster man, and that's what I class myself as. So it is.
So when Ireland are playing England in a rugby match, who would you be shouting for?
England.
Have you ever gone down south?
Oh, aye. Yeah, yeah. Well, my sister lived in the south for a... God, she must have lived down there for 20-odd years.
Yeah.
I went down and often stayed with her and went down places. Nice, and it's lovely. But it's like... And I met some really nice friends down in Tipperary where she lived. But the way they were is... how'd you say it? Like, it was totally different compared to living here. As well, the people down there just didn't care about, in the sense of, not them all, but the majority of the people, they just got on with their life. They didn't care what was happening in Northern Ireland, you know what I mean? And whether I was a Protestant, whether I was black, whether I was white, I got on very well with all the people.
Yeah.
And they knew that I was a Protestant, and even some of them knew that I was actually an ex-soldier and all, but there never was an issue. The issue would have been more in the north, where up here was, it was the stigma that in, I suppose in a sense, is in the Catholic says, you know, he was a Brit or he was this or whatever the case may be. But as to go to the south, I have no issues at all to go to the south. But I still don't want to be a part of the south.
Yeah. You're as you say, an Ulster man.
Yeah, well, that's to me, that's my identity of who I am and where I'm from. And that's the biggest thing that I have, is I don't think is that it should be... I know in the sense is where people who says that they want reunification, their argument is, well, it should be reunited again. But my argument is, but that's not what I want.
Okay.
Because that's not what I was born in, or that's not where I live.
So you'd like to see that border remain?
Not so much having a border, but I think is it should be left alone the way it is, and get everybody just get on. And as I said earlier on, I do think is if they go down that road and they start to poke, to try and change things, I think it'll take us to a far, far worse condition than it ever was before. And I do think it'll end up in civil war.
Yeah.
Because, and the other part of it is, out of the hundreds of thousands of ex-soldiers, for a start off, that lives in Northern Ireland, who has been trained, and they're trained how to, I suppose, fight, go to war, whatever the case may be. So to bring all of that in, I cannot ever see a peaceful solution, even if it was a case, if there was a vote to say, okay, we're going to have a United Ireland. I can never see a peaceful solution coming out of it. Because I think in the sense of what the IRA had done for near 40 years, I think the wheels will turn. And I think the Protestant community will do what they've done for years to come. And the biggest part, even in the sense, is, and I know young children now, And I've seen it here even in the town. My young son, he's 26. And I did do work with some of the kids. And I even seen it even today, where there's still the gripe between Protestant and Catholics in the town.
And do you feel that young people are being radicalised in a way, or do you think?
Most definitely is, in a sense, is that children that was born after the ceasefires, a lot of them now is a lot more bitter than maybe what their parents was in the Troubles.
Why do you say that?
Because of issues I've seen even with my own son growing up, who's 26 now, and issues we're seeing is where, even where they went to use like the Lakeland Forum facility, and this is going back, 10, 12 years, and where one of his friends actually, were fellas from the Catholic school, give him a hiding because he was a Protestant.
Yeah.
And that was even halfway through the so-called peace process. So it's there, and it is still there, and the bitterness is still there. Hey, and I know there's meant to be, seemingly now, there's going to be a Republican parade, which has never been, is through Enniskillen, I think it's this weekend, the 9th of September. And I know that's going to store up bitterness and tension, you know what I mean? And what you asked the question regarding in the remembrance bomb, for them to parade glorifying the IRA, glorifying whatever, but they even march past that point where innocent people lost their lives, it just drags the whole thing back, and it'll drag back bitterness, it'll drag back bad feeling. But that happens. I don't think they'll ever sort it out. It never will be sorted out. So it won't. Maybe in about, if the politicians today would stop this nonsense of what was in the past and move on and make it to the future, that maybe in two or three generations' time it was sort of winged out and they wouldn't have realised, or,
yeah,
do you know what I mean? It wouldn't be as bad as what it still is. I still think 20 years later after the peace process, Northern Ireland's no different in bitterness and dividedness and the way that they're divided. That's what I think. That's what I think often like. So it is. But we're only the people. Nobody listens. So they don't.
I'm listening.
Oh, no, but in my own opinion, in the likes of Stormont, all they want and all they're worried about is their own money. Keep the whole shit storing. Don't worry about people with health. Don't worry about children with education, because they don't care. Do you know what I mean? They're not. If they did care and they did care about the future, they'd be sitting down saying, right, let's get this sorted and let's get a future here properly put in place, instead of quibbling with each other all the time. Like, that's what I think of it anyway. Like, so it is.
Clive Miller, listen, thank you very much for telling me your story.
Yeah.
It's so important to get all these stories together. Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you.